We are in Nehemiah Perek Vav, chapter 6, and actually this shir is dedicated in honor of a gift from our Beit Midrash dinner last June by Shlomo Buchsbaum. That's the dedication. We are in the attempts on Nehemiah's life. First, the various groups, the Shomronim of various kinds, we had Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, tried to dissuade the Jews from building the wall. Then they tried to attack the construction of the wall. They maligned them and drained them of motivation, but there's another word for it. But they wanted to...
Discourage?
Discourage is a decent word for it. It wasn't it, but it's close enough. Now, they wanted to discourage the Jews from building. That didn't work. And now they've decided that what they need to do is take Nehemiah out of the picture. So in the beginning of Perek Vav, in the beginning of chapter 6, they told him, we want you to meet us in Kfirim Bikat Ono. And this was the first attempt. Either it's an attempt to assassinate him there, or it's an attempt to get him out of the way so that they can attack the construction. But Nehemiah sees right through it, and he declines their offer, and even as they keep on sending the offer, they send it multiple times. And then, in chapter 6, sentence 5, if you're using the art scroll, it's page 1849, we started on the second method, and I think we actually may have read it inside and discussed it. We just didn't actually do the commentary to it. But there was a blackmail element to this plot as well. So looking at the psukim, Vayishlach Elai Sanballat Kadabar Azeh Pam Hamishiz Ez Naharo. Sanballat sends this message a fifth time, the message of we should really meet, with an open letter in the hands of the youth. And the idea of the open letter we said last time could have an element of insult, could have an element of a threat, because the letter that is sent, remember we said this last time, is an accusation, or word of an accusation. Let's read it, actually. We'll do the psukim, then we'll do the commentary. Kasuv ba, in case anyone doesn't recall, over the week. Pasuk vav, sentence 6, Kasuv ba, the following is written in this letter. Bagoyim nishma v'gashmu omer. It's been heard among the nations, and Geshem, one of the allies of Sanballat, reports as well that he's hearing this. Atava ha'yehudim choshvim limrod. You and the Jews are plotting a rebellion. That's why you're building the wall. Ve'ata hovel lahem lemelech. And you are going to be their king. Things like that are what we are hearing, or things like that appeared in the letter. But the letter continues. V'gam nivim ha'amadata likro alecha b'Yerushalayim. You have also established nivim. Nivim sounds like prophets. We'll come back to that. To declare about you in Jerusalem, a more melech b'Yehuda. To say there is a king in Judea. V'ata, and now, yishama la'melech kadavurim ha'ela. The king's going to hear things like this. V'ata l'chani v'atza yachdav. Let's take counsel. That's the content of the letter, to which Vashlachai Lav Pasukhet, sentence 8, I sent back to him Lamor, saying, Lo niya kadvarim ha'ela. There was never any such thing. We're not plotting any sort of revolt. Asherata omer, which you are saying, people are saying, Kimilibcha tavodam, you're making it all up. He sees right through everything that's in this letter. And he says, not only that, I don't even think people are saying this. I think you're making it all up. Ki chulam biyareimo sanu, they're all intimidating us. Lemor is saying, they're trying to intimidate us, trying to get us not to try to build. Ve'atocha zeges yadai. And now that last clause, we're still going to need to translate, so I'm going to hold that clause. We're not quite there yet. Fundamentally, though, this is a charge that everybody thinks you're trying to rebel, and it really wouldn't do for the king to mysteriously somehow hear about this. This is familiar to us, and here we tie together two parts of this book. When was the last time we heard this charge of you want to rebel, and that's why you're building a wall. Ezra, right. Ezra chapter 4. Ezra chapter 4, which gave us such a headache, is now back. Go back for 2 minutes to Ezra chapter 4, sentences 7 to 16. It is on page 1821. In the beginning of that chapter, we learned that the enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin, meaning the Samaritans, have heard that we're building a Beit HaMikdash, they're building a temple. They say, we want to join. Zerubbabel says, you're not joining. It's not for you and us to build this house of God together. And Cyrus said it should be a house of God, so there. Then we were told that the Samaritans hired people against them to disrupt their plans all through the time of Koresh, all through the time, into the time of Darius. We threw in a reference to Achashverosh for some reason that we discussed back then. And then we were told about an event that occurred in the days of Artaxasta. And the big debate we had was, when did this occur? Is this occurring during the construction of the temple, meaning before even Ezra shows up? Or is this simply an illustration of Samaritan opposition that is pulled from later in history? Right? That was our major question. And the way the story played out there, take a look. In sentence 7, they send a letter via Rechum and Shimshai, who are Persians. And the letter says, you know, these Jews are building a wall in order to defend themselves. Because you know what these Jews always do in Jerusalem. They always rebel against the throne. They want to have a defense, and then they will be, they're going to declare themselves autonomous. And the result is, in fact, Artaxasta says, halt to the construction. Right? If you flip over to the next page, page 1823, sentence 17, the king sends a message back to Rechum and Shimshai, and he says, you know, we read the letter, and understand exactly what you're talking about, so therefore the construction should come to a halt, and it remains halted until the second year of King Darius, when Haggai says, guys, it's time to continue building. Okay. That story, back there, sounds an awful lot like the story here. Right? The story back there, a letter goes to the king, and it's Artaxasta, right? And the letter says, these Jews are building a wall, and then they're going to rebel. Now, we have Sanballat saying, you know, people are saying you're building this wall, and you're going to rebel. So that puts the thought into my head, at any rate, that maybe this, now, Nehemiah 6, is when that story took place. It's the same thing. That's the scroll. When the sentence six in our chapter says that there's a scroll sent by Sanballat that says the Jews want to rebel, they're building this wall, that's the scroll. That's the letter that they send with Rechum and Shimshai. It makes so much sense. Plus the fact that, again, as we noted before, that letter, if the story occurred in Ezra 4, chronologically within Ezra, we didn't understand. They weren't building a wall. They're just building the Beit HaMikdash. So you could say it was just a false charge, and they bribed Rechum and Shimshai to say it. Or you could just say, no, it's reporting an event that occurs later as an illustration of what it was that the Samaritans were trying to do. So I looked and looked and looked and tried to find somebody else who said this, that this is the same. And it took a lot of digging. But then I found source number one. From a book called The Archaeological, Historical, and Textual Studies in Honor of Hanan Eshel. Okay. Dr. Elizabeth S. Fried is the author of the paper. This paper really deals, you see the title, The Artaxerxes Correspondence of Ezra IV, Nehemiah's Wall, and Persian Provincial Administration. The essay that I'm quoting here in number one is not a traditional view of the book. The essay is coming from the perspective that parts of the book of Ezra and Nehemiah are authentic and parts of it are grafted in from other stories or things that scribes inserted and so on. But it's not important for our purposes. What is important is the connection that the author makes between Ezra 4 and Nehemiah 6. Take a look at source number 1, please. If the proposed letter of Sanballat is original to the memoir, meaning if that's really part of the book, then it explains the letter from Rechum and Shimshai to Artaxerxes quoted in Ezra 4. As Wright demonstrates, the events reported in the correspondence could not have taken place prior to Nehemiah's visit, since neither the king, nor Nehemiah, nor Hanani, for that matter, seemed to know about it. He says, look, Whatever she says, look, I assume Lisbeth is female. She says, think about this. If Ezra 4, a letter going to King Artaxerxes saying the Jews are building a wall and they're going to rebel, if that really happened before Nehemiah's time, how did Nehemiah get away with asking the king for the right to build the wall? He told you don't do it. It doesn't make any sense to think that this story occurred earlier in the reign of King Artaxerxes, and he said, stop building. And then Nehemiah said, well, I'm really sad about the city of the graveyard of my ancestors. And he said, oh, okay, you can go ahead and build. It doesn't make any sense. Not to mention, Nehemiah makes no mention of it when he's talking, his fear of approaching the king and all. Like, there's nothing about it at all. That's number one. Number two, nor could it have been written after Nehemiah's governorship. It can't be that the events of that letter occurred after Nehemiah's time. For either Nehemiah's wall had already been completed by then, in which case the correspondence could not have occurred. It's already done. Or we'd have to suppose that Nehemiah's attempt was aborted, and that a second attempt recorded in the correspondence was also aborted. You have to assume Nehemiah didn't succeed in completing the wall, which doesn't match the text. And also, that means that you're just missing a whole piece of the story. The latter option strains credibility. This leaves Nehemiah's tenure as the most likely time. It makes sense to think that the letter that succeeded in blocking the construction in Ezra 4 is the letter that Sanballat is sending to Nehemiah in Nehemiah 6. Now, the truth is, there's another way you could read it. And that is to take the view that there are multiple kings named Artaxerxes, because there were. Aside from the Talmud's view that Artaxerxes is a throne name, like Paro, Abimelech, that type of a thing, an inherited title, the Persian record has three kings named Artaxerxes. So it's not, it's not beyond the pale to say there were multiple kings Artaxerxes and go home with that. But her point, I think, is well taken. And she says, elsewhere I've tried to show that local governors like Sanballat, Tobiah, and Gashmu the Arab, members of the Achaemenid administration of beyond the river, that's the region, were the type of people whom the author of Ezra 4 had in mind when he used the term Am Haaretz to refer to the people who had bribed Rechum and Shimshai to send the letter to the king. The fingerprints are all over it. It fits. Only people of the rank of these provincial governors would have had the access and the means to bribe the Baal Tam, the deputy satrap of beyond the river, and his secretary to write the slanderous letter quoted in Ezra 4. So it makes sense to her, and that was the idea that I was trying to find support for. There's only one catch with this idea. With the idea that the letter that we read before is the same... is the same as the letter that now we're looking at here. And that is the success of that letter. Because that means that when Artaxerxes gets this letter about Nehemiah's construction in Nehemiah 6, when Sanballat leaks this letter to him via Rechum and Shimshai, at that point he says, stop building. And we have no reference whatsoever to that happening here. As far as the book of Nehemiah is concerned, they're going to succeed. They're going to finish building, and that's going to be that. So that's the weakness of this one. So I have here two different possible approaches to it. Either this is the same letter as in Ezra 4, in which case I don't understand, because that shows that they succeeded in halting it. Or this is a different letter, but then I don't know when it happens. Because if it happens before Nehemiah, I don't understand why Artaxerxes lets him build. If it happens after Nehemiah, the wall's already in place. If it happens during Nehemiah, then Iker Chasim and Asefer, you're missing everything. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
The time between Ezra's receiving the mail and Nehemiah, years, like something?
We don't know. Could be short, could be decades. That's part of the problem, is because you don't know which Artaxerxes this is, you don't know exactly when this was. Which just opens the door for a lot of different answers. Now, the easiest answer to satisfy everybody in this score is that it occurs over a period of decades and there are multiple Artaxerxes. That's the easiest answer for this. It fits the fact that the Persians have multiple Artaxerxes. The Gemara seems to think there can be multiple Artaxerxes. And you can go home with that answer and be fine. But that's the challenge here. But I wanted to at least show you, you see this charge as being made to Nehemiah. At the very least, what we see here is that this was a real this should have been a real concern for him, that someone's going to say to the king, you can't let the Jews build this wall, because if you do, they're going to rebel. So Sanballat sends this letter. In chapter 6, sentence 5, we found out that it was sent as an open letter. It was not sealed. So take a look at source number 2 on your sheet. Umilevada davar hazeh, aside from this, shalach, meaning aside from the previous assassination attempt, shalach od biyado igeret ptucha mibelichotam, he sent him another letter, but open, without a seal. Ukeomer, as if to say, lo beseser dibarti, I didn't speak to you in secret. He's borrowing Tanakh phraseology there. Lo beseser dibarti. I did not speak to you in secret. Anyone who wants to, go ahead. And when you're sending an accusation, that's a loaded thing to do. So that's one. Yeah, that piece of it is, it's an invitation for everybody to read it, and now it's a public accusation. And he says, everybody knows. And Gashmu reports that he's hearing it everywhere. And the charge is against Nehemiah personally. Now here's a really interesting thing. In sentence 7, Gam Nevi'im he'emadata likro alecha birushalayim. The word is, Nehemiah, that you have established prophets. That's what we think the word means. Prophets, right? If you're looking in the art scroll on page 1825, they translate it as... Do they say prophets?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting thing, because Rashi doesn't think so.
Here I've got these.
Oh, it's not 1825. I'm sorry. I was looking at Ezra. Page 1849. I apologize. So they say here, set up prophets. That's correct. Gita, what do you have?
They have fluent speakers.
Fluent speakers. They are taking Rashi. Rashi has a different read, that it's not an allegation that you've set up prophets. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 3. We discussed back when we learned Daniel a few years ago, that the word Navi can come from the word Lehavi, to bring, like someone who brings a message, but it's more likely from Niv. As Rashi says here, Nevi'im ba'alei lashon, people of the tongue, and he quotes you the pasuk from Yeshaya, borei niv svatayim, God is the one who creates the niv of the lips. It means speech. The Navi is the one who speaks, right? That was our point in Daniel, was that Daniel is understood by almost everyone, a Barbanel being on the outside, but almost everyone to not be a Navi, and we didn't know why. He has these magnificent dreams, and he interprets dreams, and he sees what's going to happen down the line historically for the Jews. Why are you not a prophet? Why are you not a Navi? And so he said, it could be because he's never told, go tell this to people. The point of Navi being Lahavi, one who brings a message, or Niv, one who speaks. And Nehemiah and Daniel is told just the opposite. He's told, seal this up so no one will understand it. And he did a really good job. Yeah?
But wouldn't they be Nivim instead of Nivim?
Right, so the question then will become one of jargon and just the lingo that people develop. And why would it be Nevi'im instead of being Nivim or something along those lines? But that could just be explained by human speech just as well. Even the word Niv itself, I'm not sure how to conjugate. In other words, I don't know what Niv really is. It's a noun?
It's a noun.
Yeah, so what you say, how would you say someone with a person of Niv?
As an adjective for Niv, could they not be a verb?
Well, it's not a verb for sure.
But
what would you?
It's not a verb.
Right.
There may not exist a verb.
Right. I don't know. Either way, Lahavi also is very weak in terms of Nivi'im. Right? It would be Mivi'im, effectively. Bringers of messages. But Rashi seems to think, then, that it's the way Gita's translation, the Sansino one does it, that the allegation is, Nehemiah, you've taken people who know how to talk, and you've set them up in the city to tell people that you're going to be the next king. However, almost everyone on this takes it as prophet. And that's what the Malbim does, for example. Take a look at source number 4. Malbim makes reference to something which we're going to see shortly within the chapter, that there's going to be someone by the name of Shemaya who is identified as a false prophet. And there it's false prophet for real. Shetovia v'san. Yeah, that sounded strange. Shetovia v'san Balat sachru et Shemaya shayanavi sheker shohi nave shayi amelach b'Yerushalayim. Tovia and son Balat hire Shemaya, who is a genuine false prophet, to prophesy that he will be the king in Jerusalem. V'shenechemya yi amelach, and then Nechemya will be the king. V'hein sachru et hanaviim shebeid atzarach yomush Nechemyas charam. And they hired the prophets to say, when asked, Nehemiah hired us. Make it look like he is plotting a coup.
Political intrigue?
Oh yes, very much so. That's the idea. Now, keep in mind, if this sounds distant to you, the idea of hiring false prophets, remember where we stand in Jewish history. Who is the last of the Nevi'im that we have in Tanakh? Malachi, that's right. Malachi, who is either contemporary with this story or right before this story, part of the confusion about when Nehemiah lives. So Nevuah, prophecy, is still a real thing to people. They're still familiar with the idea that someone can come to you and speak on behalf of God, but false Nevi'im are also part of that game. They've always been part of that game, and they want to promote themselves. So that's the idea here, is he's taking advantage of an atmosphere in which you don't have real prophets running around, certainly at large, in mass. We only know of one from Malachi's time. There could be others whose words aren't recorded, but certainly not prevalent. And you have false prophets, and now mixing Nehemiah into that game. But here's an interesting question. Are there people really saying this? Are there people saying Nehemiah is going to be the king? What do you think?
No,
do you think Sambalat's making this up out of whole cloth?
Just a
game.
I'm with Dahlia. Yeah. I think there are people saying this. Because first of all, it makes sense. You've come back after the prophesied 70 years of the exile are over. You have built a temple. You are building the walls of Jerusalem. Do you not think that a king is next? And do you not think that the man who has succeeded in getting you the material means, and in actually constructing the wall, and in defending against foreign attacks, do you not think he's Mashiach? I mean, we went on less evidence for Bar Kokhba. You know, I think absolutely there are people who are saying it. What Sanballat is doing is he's turning it into something that will be, you know, that can be declared treason by the king. But I think people are saying this anyway. Ralph?
He's already passing himself off as an elite, so it's easy to...
Well, not passing himself off. He is an elite.
He's doing it for his own personal gain.
Let me come back to the personal gain point, because we're gonna have to come back to what's in it for Nehemiah. But I think so. I think that people are already saying it, and you wonder what Nehemiah thinks about the claims that he is going to be the king, given the role he's playing, given the work he's doing. How does Nehemiah feel about that? Is it, oh no, that's terrible, I have no aspiration for that, I want to go back and be the cupbearer to Artaxasta? Or is it, you know, wouldn't it be great to really restore the monarchy of the Jewish people? One wonders, and Malbim is going to wonder it, when we see the next piece of this parak. This is not, I'm not just randomly speculating, there are things in this chapter that are going to make it seem like that's exactly what's going through Nehemiah's head. Well, Nehemiah is not yet, Debbie.
But he's not very modest. He just spent paragraphs talking to God to make sure God knew how great he was.
Well, either that or defending himself.
Well, I don't know. You know how I objected to that.
That's fine. You're entitled to object. I read it as self-defense, and I think that it fits, but you're entitled to read it differently.
Well, I read it as self-aggrandizement.
Okay.
This is not an elevated or elevating story, that's for sure.
What do you mean?
Well, it's all political intrigue, and where's the higher purpose?
Well, keep in mind that at every step of the way, he turns to God. Every step of the way, he reminds the people, and he reminds himself that this is altruistic.
He's just doing it for his own
benefit. But wouldn't he have been criticized by Hazal for... You know, he was criticized for something that we could view as defensive.
Yeah. Couldn't he have been criticized for wanting to take kingship? I mean, that's...
I don't know. The way I look at it is that, if anything, they could be very positive about this idea. Maybe we should all want that he should succeed and become king. Maybe it's a bad thing that it doesn't play out that way. You know, we're going to end the book under the Persians. Spoiler alert. And eventually the Greeks, right? Maybe it would have been great if Nehemiah had actually become king. Maybe that's what we should have wanted. So Nehemiah is not intimidated.
And the other thing is that even though we know Nehemiah is a very wealthy man, because after all, he can feed all these people,
right.
We know the man has great wealth. We don't hear about him having, like Melech Shlomo, many horses, many wives,
right.
All this other aggrandizement that goes along with it. If anything, we see Melech Shlomo is always collecting taxes and always getting money from the people and impoverishing the nation in order to enrich himself. Nehemiah, on the other hand, just always seems to be giving it away.
Right. I mean, but to be fair, Shlomo also gives a lot away, uses a lot to support people. It's true that he is criticized for the emphasis on wealth, and it's clear Malachim talks at length about where his stuff came from and all the exotic materials he amalgamated, and that's all true. And it's true that Nehemiah, look, he took great pains in the previous chapter to say, I take nothing for myself, and I spend of my own. So that's certainly true.
Well,
no, we
I
like
think
this.
That that's very much a defense of supporting what Rabbi Krupchina was saying, where he's defending himself. He's saying, I could be the kind of rich guy who's taking from all of you, but I'm not. I'm handing it out.
Right.
I'm sharing my wealth.
Debbie just doesn't want to be reminded of it by the person who's doing it.
Yaluchah
zar velo picha. Let strangers praise you, not your own mouth.
Right.
Ralph, and then we're going to go on because there's so much going on in this story here.
Netanyahu was accused of wanting to erect the dynasty.
And the next thing, chapter 6, sentence 8. So in Nehemiah's response is, Lo nihya, it ain't so. You're the only one saying this. It is not, around, no way. And he says in sentence 9, Kulam mi'arim osanu. They are trying to intimidate us. Or Mitzudat David, or Rashi reads that they are intimidated by us. And instead, he says, now here's the key, here's the phrase that's very hard to render. You're saying that our hands should be weak from the work and it should not be done. V'ata chazek es yadai, literally strengthen my hands. So Ralbag Mitzudat David, Malbim read this as what's called a bitmiha. This is something that's being expressed in amazement. You want us to stop building, and now you're going to say, we want to strengthen your hands. We want to help you, Nehemiah. There's this rumor going around. Let's work together to diffuse the rumor. He says, come on, I can't buy that. That's one way to read it. I brought you in source number 5, Mitzudat David. Lishavar, in the past, Atem kuchem ayisem afchidim osana. You all wanted to frighten us. Kisam rubab ra pachad yirpu yidei hemi melechas binyana chama velo teyase od. You said that out of fear, their hands would be weak from building the wall, and they wouldn't do it. Ve'im kein lo'ivim techshavu. So you were enemies. That's what we understood. We had it very clear. You're against us. Ve'echen kein tomara telechazek es yadai beit sanachona. He says, how now are you suddenly encouraging me, giving me good advice, and now the enemy becomes the friend? Ain't zos. Ain't no such thing. No way. And that's a simple read of the pasuk. Ibn Ezra has a different read, and Rashi goes along with this read, I believe. He reads, and take a look at source number 6, that it's an offer from Nehemiah. He says, he's trying to appease Sanballat. He's saying, look, door's open. You're welcome to join. Not to help build. Right? Not to help build the Beis HaMikdash. Not to build the temple. But the walls of Jerusalem. Look, you want to help us defend? Gesundheit. Absolutely, you're invited. So Nehemiah doesn't take the bait in this story. But then we get attempt number three. And this is the most fascinating of the bunch. So we are in chapter 6, and we are now up to sentence 10. Vani basi beis Shemaya ben Delaya ben Mehetavel. Three generations. This is somebody with lineage. I came to the house of Shemaya, son of Delaya, son of Mehetavel, v'hu atzur. The word v'hu atzur, the phrase v'hu atzur, is a very hard phrase to render, and there are multiple interpretations which we're going to come back to. Right now it just says he was confined indoors. So we'll talk more about why exactly this person might be confined indoors. But I came to him, Nehemiah reports. Vayomer. And he said the following. Niva'ed al beis ha'elokim el toh ha'echal. Let us convene in the house of God, right, this new temple that you've built, the inside of the heichal. Heichal, sanctuary, can mean the temple as a whole, or can mean the inner sanctum, where ritual sacrifice goes on. V'nisgirad al sos ha'echal, and we'll close the doors. Ki ba'im lahargecha, v'layla ba'im lahargecha, because they're coming to kill you, and tonight they're coming to kill you. So Nehemiah goes to visit this person, Shemaya ben Delaya ben Mehetavel, who says to him, we should be meeting inside the sanctuary because there's a threat on your life tonight. So that's where we should go. Va'omra, and I said, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ha'ish kamoni yivrach, what do I look like to you? He says, is a man like me going to flee? Umi chamoni asher yavol al-heichal v'chai, and who like me could enter the heichal, the sanctuary, and live? Lo avo, I ain't going. That's his response. Now, we have to understand what his point is, what this whole back and forth is, but I just want to finish the sequence. Va'akira v'hine lo elokim shalacho. I realized that he had not been sent by God. Ki ha'nevu'ah diber alai. He was speaking nevu'ah upon me. He was the false prophet hired by Tobiah and Sanballat. Leman sachur hu. Now this one also admits of multiple translations. I'm going to take one way to read it. Leman sachur hu. He's speaking this way because he was hired. Leman iras. That would be afraid. Ve'ese kein. That would follow his advice. Vichatasi, and I would have sinned. V'ayalahem l'shem ra l'man yicharfuni, and then they would have grounds to shame me. Okay, what in the world happened in this story? Clearly there's a plot. Clearly someone is saying something to Nehemiah, and he believes that it's false. But I have a whole bunch of questions here. What are the questions we should be asking as we read this? What things don't make sense here? Yeah?
How did he have to go to Shemaiah?
Yeah, first of all, why did you go to Shemaiah's house? Well, if you think that there are false prophets around, and you think that this person might be one of them, why are you going there? I mean, that's total incrimination. Debbie?
JBS has Bruce Tim set up as a poem.
As a poem? What do you mean?
Well, set up as a poem.
You mean, let us go to the house of God is like a song they sang?
Well, let us meet in the house of God, ending it by night they are coming to kill you.
That's some song.
Yeah,
it has a nice rhythm. I don't like the ending.
It just set up your fire.
Interesting. Okay. I think they're viewing it as an oracle of some kind.
Maybe, as a pronouncement.
Yeah.
As an oracle, yeah.
Yes.
If he's housebound, why is he proposing that they meet somewhere else?
Yeah, how homebound are you if you're saying, let's go meet somewhere else? This is a good question as well.
Why is he homebound?
Right. Well, and not only that, how does he know it's not true? How do you know this isn't true?
But if he's supposed to be meeting him in the Holy of Holies, in a place where he can't go, I'm like,
how many times have we seen prophets tell people to do things that are, in fact, halachically prohibited? For example, in the Judges, right? Gidon, right, builds an altar and brings an offering outside of the Mishkan, outside of the tabernacle. Eliyahu brings one on Mount Carmel, outside of the Beit HaMikdash, outside of the temple. We have what's called Hara'at Shah. Ezra did it earlier. He brought korbanot. He brought offerings that were not the ones on the books. We have a long-standing practice of special dispensation. Why couldn't it be that, in fact, this is true? We know that they want to kill him. Right? That's old news by now.
But he's been asked several times to do things that he knows are dangerous.
Yeah.
And
by whom?
Hello. Again. Another time. Once again.
Well, what else was he asked and by whom? To do something dangerous. The only thing I know of was when they tried to lure him out into their trap. But there it wasn't posed as something from a prophet.
Fairly simple thing. No, I'm not going to do that.
Right. So, the simple answer for why he would go to Shemaiah is that he wants to silence a false prophet. Meaning, he believes this is a false prophet, an agent, in fact, of Sanballat, and he wants to shut him down. So he says, I'm going to his house in order to do that. And that would be the simple read. But Malbim has a whole different way to read what's going on here. And this goes back to the question of what Nehemiah is thinking when he hears about people talking about him being a king. Source 7. Some al libo lachkor al hanivuah shenibei Shemaya alav shiyem melech biyehuda. He said, you know what? I want to investigate. There's a fellow Shemaya who is telling people that I'm going to be the king in Judea. Maybe it's true. So he says, I want to find out. He went to the house of Shemaiah, brackets, kiyad sur v'choleh. V'lo yachol lekro osoi lav, because Shemaiah is ill. We're going to come back to the reasons why Shemaiah may be stuck in the house, but that's what Malbim believes, that Shemaiah is homesick. And that's why Nehemiah, the powerful governor, is not able to summon Shemaiah to him. There's a whole other discussion that runs through the Navi about who gets to summon whom. Kings get to summon prophets, or prophets summon kings. But that's not for right now. Lachkor v'ledrosh al hadavar. So he went in order to investigate. Nehemiah wants to see, is this for real? Shemaiah is stuck at home. He is atzur. The word atzur is a really interesting word for this. I gave you two references in source number 8 for the word atzur. Let's take a look at them, please. Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1, chapter 21, sentence 8 is the story of the city of Nob. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you want... Sorry? 701, thank you. This is when David is on the run from Shaul. He goes to the city of Nob, and he says to the people in Nob, to Achimelech the Kohen, he says, I'm on a mission from Shaul, and you are supposed to give me food, and you're supposed to give me a weapon. And the people, in fact, do. And then you get sentence 8. Visham ish me'avdei Shaul bayomahu. There was a man there, one of the servants of Shaul, who was there that day. Netzar lifnei Hashem. That word again, otzer. Netzar before God. And this was Doeg ha'adomi, who is described here as being Abir Haroim, literally chief of the shepherds. The Talmud takes it as the head of the Sanhedrin. The title of chief of the shepherds doesn't mean that he's a shepherd, which explains a lot, because what we're going to find out is that he has Shaul's ear and gives him counsel in a way that is not consistent with the chief shepherd. So Doeg is there, but he is a Netzar in front of God. So that's one use of the word atzur. They translate it here as as lingering before God. That's one use. The other use, Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah chapter 36, sentence 5, is on page 1159. There is a message for King Jehoiakim, which is recorded on a scroll, and is supposed to be brought to the king. And there you find that Yirmiyahu summons Baruch ben Neriah, and Baruch writes down everything that Nehemiah has told him on a scroll, and then, Vayitzaveh Yirmiyahu es Baruch, Yirmiyahu instructs Baruch, Lemor, Ani Atzur, Lo Uchal Lavo Beit Hashem. But here they don't translate it as I am lingering. Here they translate it as I am detained. I can't go to the temple where you are going to read this scroll aloud. So the commentators classically say he's imprisoned by the king. Sorry?
In hiding.
That will be another explanation. Either he's imprisoned or he's in hiding. So the commentators traditionally look at the first one, the one with Doeg, and read it as he keeps himself there, because he wants to be before God in the Mishkan in Nov, in the sanctuary in Nov. In other words, it's a voluntary atzur, right? I'm there because I want to be, in Doeg's case. And they classically read Yirmiyahu as confined, whether in fear of attack, or whether because the king has said to him, you stay home. But either way, it's involuntary. So the question is, what's going on with Shemaiah? So the Da'at Mikra reads it as, he's just alone at home. He takes the view that atzur means hanging out at home, even though we usually use the word atzur to sense and a sense of confinement, right? On stop signs in Israel, right? It's atzur. The Malbim, though, takes it like Yirmiyahu's imprisonment. When he says he is ill and unable to leave, he would like to go out, but he's not able to. And then in terms of Alina's question, so how is he going to meet at the Mishkan? Sorry, it wasn't. Who asked? Sorry. Oh, Tovas. Okay. Sorry. The answer is he'll figure out a way. He'll figure out a way to get out there. Ibn Ezra, on the other hand, says that it's actually like the story with Doeg being in front of the sanctuary, the Mishkan. If you take a look at source number 9, V'hu Atzur, Lifnei HaBore, in front of the Creator, Le'avdo, to serve him. Ka'otzer atzmo mehana'a, like somebody who abstains from pleasure. Ha'atzur b'tanit, the one who is confined in a fast. Ke'do'eg adomi shaya ne'etzar, like do'eg. In other words, he's immersed in religious or pseudo-religious ritual. Right? If he's a false prophet, then he's pretending. Right? He's saying, I cannot leave my home. I'm currently communing with the Almighty. Right? Or I'm engaged in a 12-day fast, day and night, you know? That kind of a thing. So we have different schools of thought on what's going on, but it could just be, he's sick, or he's home alone, and now what we're saying is, Nehemiah went to see him when he was alone, or it could be playing up his role as a false prophet or potentially real prophet. Nehemiah goes to see him when he's engaged in some kind of religious retreat in his house. Yeah.
That makes him a nice guy, trustworthy guy.
Assuming it's true, assuming this is a real ritual and not just something he's putting on in order to convince others that he's for real. He's wearing sackcloth. Well, it's a lack of clarity, and I think it's an intentional lack of clarity. You're not supposed to read this and know what's going on. I think that's the point, is where we're left to doubt.
But Nehemiah's trusting him.
Well, trusting him that he's safe in his house at any rate. So he says they're coming tonight, it's imminent, it's a nighttime attack, but Tzedat David says you can't protect yourself at night. And Shemaiah says, go hide in the Heichal. Why hide in the Heichal? So one might look at it and say, well, it's the sanctuary and you'll be safe, but of course Sanballat isn't going to care about it being in the sanctuary. So Rashi gives you a more practical explanation. Actually, I didn't bring it on the sheet, sorry. We did discuss it though a while back. We discussed it when we started this chapter, and we noted that the walls were not yet done because they were missing doors. So that view is that the reason why he says to go there is because this place has doors you can actually close. It's a fortress. That's the idea that Rashi expresses. It has doors unlike the wall. Yeah.
Nehemiah, I'm mixing Nehemiah with Yeshaya.
Yeah.
He's not a Kohen.
Correct.
Okay, sorry about that.
No Kohen here.
The whole theory.
Yeah. So that's the plot. Okay, the plot is get him to hide in there. We are left not to understand yet whether this is true or false. We're not given enough information. What is it, though, since we believe in the end, at the end of the story, we believe, as Nehemiah does, that this is a false prophecy. So what was Shemaiah trying to achieve? What was the plot about exactly? What was his goal?
To make him look guilty, to incriminate himself.
So how would this make him look guilty?
That he's running away.
He's running away. Right? So one approach will be, take a look at source number 13. Dahlia's approach is the approach that Rabbi Zakheim takes. He says, Nehemiah recognized that an escape, quote, to the temple would lend credence to the accusations being leveled against him. In seeking the protection that the temple might afford, such protection was common from ancient times through the late Middle Ages in Europe, right? The whole sanctuary idea, which does show up a couple of times, first in Chumash, Meim Mizbechit Yekachan Lamut, and then further along, and in the Hunchback of Notre Dame, right, where he declares sanctuary. Like, it's a common theme.
Yes, sanctuary.
Right. So Nehemiah would, in effect, be admitting that he had planned a rebellion per Sanballat's allegation, but had now realized it wouldn't succeed, and now I better run into the temple to be safe. The weakness of this is that in the text he said it would be a chet for me. Unless you take the word chet broadly, it doesn't mean violation of a particular law, it means impropriety. And that would be the way to take it. That's one approach to what's going on. This is a plot meant to make Nehemiah look guilty. What else would you say? There are a lot of different ways to read this. I got five.
Because he didn't want it to have him available to be killed.
Oh, you mean you're cornering yourself. That's clever. I haven't seen anybody make that suggestion. It doesn't fit exactly with Nehemiah's words when Nehemiah, you know, talks about them being able to accuse him or shame him. But it's a good point. You're cornered once you're in there. Yes, Rebecca.
But it doesn't really look good that you go to Chol Hashem, which is a place you shouldn't be.
So the question is, am I now giving myself a reputation as a sinner by having gone into this place that's supposed to be, and this goes back to what Devi, I think, had said also earlier, that this is, you look like you're sinning, you're going into the sanctuary where you're not supposed to go. Take a look at Rashi in source number 10.
Or you're above the law.
Right. Which I'm going to come back to momentarily. V'hayalahem l'shem ra. It will be a bad name that they can then use. L'man sheyalahem l'shem ra l'charfeini ba'aveirazu. They will be able to shame me for this sin. And this to me is really important because it goes back to last chapter and the need for self-defense. Nehemiah insists that he is doing everything above board and he's proclaimed to the world that he's doing everything above board. Why is Nehemiah so afraid of these attacks? Because he thinks people are going to suspect that he's doing this selfishly and he doesn't really believe in it. Think about it. Everybody else showed up at least one generation earlier, right? If not more, depending again on the chronology here. They showed up with Zerubbabel. They showed up with Ezra, or they suffered there all along under the Samaritans, even worse. Here comes this Johnny come lately, who's been hanging out in Persia as an official of the throne. He has not suffered with everybody else. He's got all the money in the world, able to support this huge entourage. And maybe he's just there for his own ends. Maybe he's there for the empire's purposes. And maybe he's lining his pockets, and that's his need to defend himself in chapter 5. And maybe he doesn't believe in this whole sanctity of the temple at all. And when it's convenient for him, he's going to waltz right in. And so there's a concern that he has. They're going to show me up as a non-believer. They're going to use this in order to undermine me. That's a second possibility. That would also explain when he says in that sentence, not just would someone like me run away, but who like me can go into the temple and live? I don't belong there. Now we're going to come back to that because it's actually not true. So we have to come back to that phrase. It's not so straightforward, but that's what it sounds like he's saying. Third approach, Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra simply says what I brought for you in source number 12. L'shem ra alai, shesagardi hadlatot. I get a bad reputation for closing the doors, meaning, yecharfuni, they'll shame me, shepachadati mehem v'nechbesi, the fact that they made me turn tail and run. That's the issue. They make me look like a coward.
But then how does chatati fit?
Again, it has to be a broad meaning of chatati. But what he's saying is, all these people have relied on me for leadership. When Sanballat had his forces arrayed against them, I was the one who said, "We can do this. We can manage to hold the line against the enemy assault. And you go here, and you go there. And we're going to blow the shofar, and everything's going to be fine." If I turn tail and run, now what? They're going to lose all confidence. So that's even Ezra's political read, which I have to say has a lot to recommend it. It fits the story. Yeah.
So one, somebody says that it makes him look guilty, and the other one says that it makes him look like a coward.
Yeah.
It's basically all appearances that he's worried about.
Yeah, very much so.
Right.
Because that's what he can't control.
It's the same thing. It's one is guilty, one
Okay. Right. Or there's a Rashi, which I brought you in number 11, which suggests that the point isn't that. The point is that if he goes to hide in the sanctuary, guess what's going to happen to the work on the wall? V'kibel shochad min Sanballat v'chaveirav. Even though Rashi gave a separate explanation in number 10, he gives this explanation where he says, l'havchidet Nechemya k'dei levatel es hamalacha. The point is to intimidate Nechemya, and now the work on the wall is going to stop because he's hiding in the sanctuary. And so that's another possibility. And then there's one more note, which goes back to what somebody said before, which Malbim is going to say, we're not there yet. Which is to make people think that in fact he is allied with this false prophet. Meaning, he's going to go running into the sanctuary, right? People are going to say, what are you doing? Well, Shemaya said that I have to go here because they're going to attack me. Huh. So he's in league with Shemaya. This Shemaya who's been telling people that Nehemiah is going to be king, he is guilty. Not just it's going to make him look guilty because he's running away, it's going to make him look guilty because he's in an alliance with Shemaya. That's the idea. So you have five different explanations, all of which are feasible. You could really read any of them, I think, in the text with greater or lesser success. So what does Nehemiah do? Yes. Sorry. Sorry about that. So here's Nehemiah's response. I mean, I think, to my mind, what we'll see by the end of the chapter is very elevating, but we're not going to get to it today. But Nehemiah's response. So first of all, he says, does someone like me run away? Right? Which is just, you know, he's John Wayne. He says, Ha'ish kamoni yivrach. Does someone like me flee? Take a look at Mitzudat David in source number 14. V'chi'ish kamoni yivrach min ha'oyev. Halo l'klimate chashev. It will be an embarrassment. Ukeomer, it's like saying, Hinei gamzroi moshlali lihilachemi mo. My arm is powerful. Let Sanballat show up at my doorstep. Let's see what happens. That's the Nehemiah response. That's his first part. And then you have his second part, where he says, how could a czar, a stranger, take refuge in the Heichal? Now, take a look, please, at Bamidbar, Numbers, chapter 3, sentence 10. I didn't put it on your sheet, I apologize. Numbers, chapter 3, sentence 10. It is on page... Sorry? 329, thank you. Chapter 3, sentence 10. Because this is the key verse. Chapter 3, sentence 10, it's page 329. Yeah. This is part of the instructions for the Jews about how to take care of the items that are in the Mishkan. You see it? So the instruction is that the tribe of Levi is responsible to look after all of the different properties of the Mishkan. And the key sentence is sentence 10, the end of the paragraph there. V'es Aharon v'es banav tifkod. Instruct Aharon and instruct his sons. V'shamru es kehunasam. They shall guard their priesthood. Meaning, the priesthood is under their control. V'azar ha-karev yumat. The czar, alien as they translate it here, meaning a non-Kohen, who approaches, shall die. Now, Nehemiah is not a Kohen. That we accept. However, this sentence is not quite the way it sounds. Rabbi Meir Simcha Kalin of Dvinsk pointed out in his Meshech Chachma commentary here in the Chumash, that Hakarev does not mean one who comes close, and we know that because a non-Kohen was allowed to come into the sanctuary. The non-Kohen, first of all, if you bring a sacrifice, you stand there when your sacrifice is brought. But there are all sorts of circumstances in which a non-Kohen could end up in the sanctuary and he does not die. So he says that's not the way to read the line. Rather, what he's saying is, do you think that I would go there in order to survive? In other words, we go back into the sentence in Nehemiah. Mi kamoni ashayavo alechal v'chai, not who like me would go into, or would someone like me go into the sanctuary and yet live, but would he go into the sanctuary to live? Would someone like me ever do that? Either I wouldn't because it would make me look like a coward, or I wouldn't because it would halt the construction, or I wouldn't because it would make people believe the allegations about me are true. But that's all he's saying. He's not actually saying he would die if he went in. But Nehemiah says, I'm not going. And I believe this is false, he says. I don't believe it. So Malbim, remember, told us, he went in to see, is this stuff true? Right? Are the prophecies of Shemaiah true? Am I really going to be the king? Something that Shemaiah said convinces Nehemiah that it's all phony. How does he know that this is false? What is it that tips him off? I don't know at this stage how you can be sure that this whole thing is false. I'm not convinced that it's false. So take a look at the first source that I brought on this. We're going to see a few, but it's going to have to be next week. But at least you'll see one answer, and that's Zakkaim in source number 13. He says, Nehemiah recognized that an escape to the temple would lend credence to the accusations being leveled against him. Meaning, that's the one that I had before. That's the one that I used before, sorry about that. That's the one he had before. Never mind. What Zakkaim argues is simply the plot is too obvious. Nehemiah sees too easily how this is going to make him look bad. And he decides this isn't a prophecy, it's a plot. It's too see-through for him. That's one view. Rashi has a second view. Rashi says that the issue is, take a look at source number 15. Hikarti bidvarav. I saw in his own words, Shalosh lacha HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'davar zeh, that God had not sent him for this purpose. She'avor aveiram ifnei pachad hamita. For me to violate a sin just because I'm afraid for my life. In other words, God would not tell me to violate a sin in order to save my life. That's what Rashi says.
The sin is entering the Heichal.
Yeah. Rashi is taking the view that there was a sin entering the Heichal, even though, again, Meshech Chachma's point is well taken. Rashi has been consistent that he believes Chait here is a sin, and that that's what's going on. But the question I have for Rashi is, I don't understand. Of course we violate to save our lives. Mm-hmm. That's a basic tenet. You do. I mean, David taking the showbread from the Mishkan in Nov was not exactly legal either.
But did Hashem order him to do that?
Well, that's what the prophet is saying. The Navi is saying, God says this is what you ought to do. So I don't really understand what Rashi is saying. To me, this is not so compelling. So what we'll see next time are two additional views, Malbim and Mitzudat David, which will offer other explanations for how it is that he knows that Shemaiah's message is false. But yes, this is the chapter of attempts on the life of Nehemiah, as the other side is getting very desperate to prevent the wall from being completed. So come back next week, God willing, and we will conclude chapter 6. And then, just for you, Debbie, in chapter 7, we get a name list.
Oh, I...